Good afternoon, everyone. We'll get going. My name's Brendan Council. Welcome to this session. Key developments in external audits, divergence from external peer reviews, and important implications on professional actuarial practice. Today we've got some speakers from PwC, so I'll just read out their bios. So first we've got Chow Chow. Chow has 15 years experience as an actuary in the insurance industry. He's worked in both core actuarial functions such as reserving, pricing and capital management, IFRS 17, and broader insurance functions such as customer technology-led modernisation, operations and strategy. He's also an auditor's expert on a number of external audits for insurance companies. Chow has also managed to, maintained a key interest in socially relevant research, professional matters and discussions, especially in longevity insurance. Graduated from the University of New South Wales with first class honours in actuarial studies with a thesis on group self-annuitisation. He's a fellow of the Actuaries Institute and a chartered enterprise risk actuary. Chow mainly practices in general insurance, but has also worked in life insurance and banking. He has also actively volunteered extensively with the Actuaries Institute, including on council and as an examiner in general insurance education. Second speaker is Nina Larkin. She is a PwC actuarial partner with over 20 years' experience in the financial services industry across Australia, New Zealand, UK and Europe. She's currently the lead PwC actuarial partner for external audits of credit risk provisions across the sector. In addition, Nina supports her clients across a range of financial, credit liquidity and stress testing and non-financial product and system risks. She's passionate about deploying actuarial capability in new and emerging areas, e.g. climate risk, generative AI and financial crime. She graduated from the University of New South Wales and is a fellow of the Actuaries Institute. Proud mum to three young children, Nina has a passion for people and leadership development. She believes working with a growth mindset helps build resilience, which has both personal and professional benefits. And finally, we have Anthony Yager. Just bear with me for a sec. Anthony is a partner in PwC Australia and leads the risk data analytics and actuarial team. He's a fellow of the Faculty of Actuaries and has significant experience in insurance, banking, financial risk modelling, predictive modelling, and predictive modelling. Prior to moving to Australia, Anthony was based in Singapore and led PwC's actuarial practice across Southeast Asia. In his role as partner at PwC, Anthony has led a number of engagements covering insurance and actuarial topics such as reserving and capital management, portfolio strategy and stress testing, and he's also assisting a number of insurers in implementing IFRS 17, quantifying their insurance associate emissions and formulating net zero transition approaches. Anthony also has extensive experience in expected credit loss modelling under IFRS 9, Basel Capital Model Build and Validation, and US CCAR Model Validation. He was previously an examiner for the Actuarial Society of South Africa and in Banking Principles and Banking Application subject, has four children and enjoys weekends outdoors with family and friends. Please welcome our speakers.
Okay, thanks everyone, and thanks Brendan for that generous introduction. Now, of course, at the Actuaries Institute, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, the Yagam people, and we pay our respect to their elders both past and present. So today we'll be talking about four main key topics. Well, firstly, we'll be covering external peer reviews and external audits. How are they similar? How are they different? What's happened and what's moved on in recent years? Secondly, we'll explore changing and evolving expectations from our regulators, including ASIC, which has an extensive audit inspections program, and how that's influenced the way that primary actuaries approach their work, particularly around the exercise of professional judgment and documentation and evidence requirements. We'll hear from Nina around what the insurance industry can learn from the banking industry when it comes to model validation and model governance, and finally, whether the banking industry can, in reverse, benefit from the professionalisation of actuaries. I'm sure people in this room would be aware of recent developments in regulation. Anthony, what's happened in the insurance space?
Thanks, Charles. So this presentation doesn't have anything on AI, climate risk. There's no exercise or meditation, but we do have lots of accounting standards and reporting stuff, so equally exciting. I think for most actuaries in the insurance industry, they've probably spent the best part of the last decade on IFRS 17 in some form or another. It's very complicated. The way the standard works is as if it's always been enforced and in play, and so you need to go back in time and measure as if it's always been effective. And it is principles-based, and so it does require a lot of judgment, and I think we'll bring up some of these kind of concepts throughout this discussion.
And Nina, similar changes have happened around IFRS 9, hasn't it?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Yeah, so for those that aren't familiar, so IFRS 9 was a standard that was introduced back in 2018, and it made the banks move away from thinking about credit losses as an incurred loss and thinking about it as an expected loss. And so the result of that meant that the banks needed to start thinking about, well, what is the range of outcomes? And so introduced all these statistical models that they never had to put in place before. And as a result of that, needed to think about, well, what is the right governance and structure around those particular models?
Yeah, and I think what's less visible to people in this room is the, in response to all of this, the International Auditing Standard Board changed and revised ISA 540, which is the standard governing auditors and how auditors approach estimates. And it introduced new accounting concepts such as how to deal with complexity, how to deal with estimation uncertainty and subjectivity, particularly around, you know, what is a misstatement? How do actuaries approach the work around assessing the risk of misstatements and also greater requirements that are being placed on evidence and documentation, both on the external actuary but also on the primary actuary. So we'll explore all of this in greater detail. Without further ado, we'll dive into the first topic, which is external peer reviews. Well, I'm sure people in this room are very familiar with external peer reviews and audits, but, you know, Anthony, is there something we've missed in recent years?
I think maybe before we get into that, Charles, I think just to cover off what we mean by an external peer review, the name itself kind of articulates that quite clearly. It's external, so it's conducted by people outside of the appointed actuary or your primary actuary role. It's a peer review, and so there's that element of collaboration and working together. Often audit, and we'll talk about that later, audit is often seen as adversarial and confrontational in some aspects, and it shouldn't be, but the EPR is very much collaborative and working together, and it is a review, which is slightly different to an audit in terms of the procedures requirements there. A couple of points there. So it's principles-based, it's covered under PS 103, and it's no longer mandatory in Australia since 2015. A number of companies still engage external parties for their EPR to kind of enhance their governance and get management and the board comfortable that the actuary's judgments are sound and that those liabilities are reasonable.
Yeah, and Anthony, as you said, you know, APRA got rid of the requirement, mandatory requirement in 2015. I think on the premise that perhaps EPRs are very similar to audits and EPRs are just an enhanced version of audits. Is that still the case?
I think back then it probably was a fair comment, Charles, but I think it has moved on from there and they are different.
So how has external audit evolved and, you know, what people in this room traditionally understood to be covered by EPRs, are they still covered by an external audit?
So I think on this slide we've covered the way that an actuarial team would be engaged on an external audit. The audit would be conducted by an audit partner who's an accountant, and they would sign an audit opinion that basically says that the financial statements of that company are true and fair. And that's the ultimate goal, that they're what they're looking for. They then need to engage experts or specialists in conducting certain procedures to make sure that they are comfortable with what they're signing off, because as an audit partner or an accountant, you may not be fully across how do you estimate insurance contract liabilities. So they typically would engage an actuarial team. It doesn't need to be in the same firm. Some companies may get an actuarial team from outside the firm, but it is more typically done within the firm. And so if PwC is your auditor, you'd probably have the PwC actuarial team working with you on this. A couple of concepts there. So it's not a review. It's actually just a detailed set of procedures. And so we will take instructions from the audit partner to say you need to do steps A, B, C all the way through. And it's governed by ASA 620 and 540 and enforced by ASIC. The way that they try and get comfort on it, there's this whole concept of materiality, and that materiality is done at a financial statement line item point of view. And so even if the overall liability is very small, if it's in a very small company, even if the dollar value difference, we would all think it's insignificant, like $500 on a $10,000 liability, the auditing standards may consider that a material misstatement. And so there's that element of difference, which we probably wouldn't look at from an EPR point of view. We'd probably just say it's reasonable. And we'll cover it a bit later, but there's different ways of looking at the overall liability in terms of the doing a methods and assumptions review, key indicators, and then controls testing as well.
Yeah, and I think that's in my experience as well. I mean, the world of external audits and EPRs have moved on. You know, a key concept here, Anthony, as you said, is this tension between what is a prescriptive auditing standard and what is a principle-based professional standard that primary actuaries are being held to. And oftentimes, you talk to CFOs, you talk to management, and they go, well, perhaps in an audit, you're not actually giving us the value that we're looking for, which is an overall conclusion of the reserves and the appropriateness and reasonableness of the overall reserves. But when you talk to ASIC, they don't expect you to perform these audits in that way, do they? It's very procedural. Mathematical integrity is a classic example. You know, whether or not you think that is a necessary procedure, that's not your opinion as an actuary. You can't just say, hey, in my professional judgment, I don't think I should do that. Well, you should. But then on the other hand, we also know that as auditors, they don't often engage auditors' experts to look at the totality of the reserves. Sometimes we only look at 60% of the primary actuary's work in an external audit. The other 40% are either not being looked at by the auditor's expert, or, as you said, Anthony, we look at it from a key indicators review perspective, which is a very different concept to an EPR and what the chief actuary or the CFO would want to get assurance for. And on the other hand, ASIC, you know, when we write these reports, board audit committee reports, there are standards that govern what have to go in there. ASIC would want to look at, you know, whether or not, as you said, misstatements, you know, minuscule amounts sometimes, but at other times, you know, documentation requirements, whether we've done that, whether we've challenged the primary actuary. And I think that's where the actuarial profession can look to the auditing standards and go, well, maybe we are missing a trick, or maybe we should improve the way we do evidence, the way we document these things. We've both done a lot of these audits and EPRs before, Anthony, so to bring it to life in a case study for the audience, would you please tell us a little bit about this very, very real-life example.
Cool. So basically what we've got on this table is a bit of a compare and contrast between an EPR exercise and an auditor's expert role, looking at areas like the nature of the work, the in-scope portfolios, methods and assumptions review, and then materiality as well. In terms of the nature of the work, as we've alluded to, the EPR is far more principles-based, whereas the auditor's expert role is really procedural. In scope for EPR, you want to get comfort on the overall set of numbers, and so you'd look at everything, whereas the auditor's expert, for example, in this case, you might do a methods and assumption review on short tail and workers' comp, and then key indicators on professional indemnity, and then CTP for this insurer might just be really small or really stable, and so the audit team themselves might just do a controls test that there's been no significant changes since last year, and the actuary wouldn't even look at it. from a methods and assumptions point of view, I think the other key point here is that the auditor's expert would look at individual methods and assumptions, and they would basically review those in a lot of detail. Whereas, again, from an EPR point of view, it is a much higher level. And materiality, there are different concepts, as we've explained earlier.
Yeah, I remember 5 years ago, Anthony, I did an EPR at the same time as an audit, and the reports for these two pieces of work looked very similar. It's unthinkable today, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they have diverged, and I think the purpose of the work has diverged, and I think that's why it probably went away a while ago, but it's come back in some form. Looking here at the data, granularity, reporting, mathematical integrity, and the type of conclusion that you give, again, we've tried to put a bit of a compare and contrast here. Data, for example, engaged as the external peer review actuary, we would not really do much independent work around the data. We look at what the primary actuary has done, what checks have they done, how have they assessed movements, how are they basically comfortable with this. Whereas in an auditor's expert role, there would be sample testing. You'd look at premiums and claims data, and the actuarial team, when they look at the reserves, would say, we've got it from here, and then the audit team would go and talk to the client and try and do some reconciliation. So it's a far more detailed set of procedures on that one. Again, the report, the EPR report, basically the EPR actuary would write up a report to say nothing's come to their attention, that these reserves are unreasonable. Whereas on an auditor's expert report, you'd issue the report not to the client, but you issue it to the audit partner, and basically say that the methods and assumptions used are appropriate and in line with the procedures that you've conducted. So it is a slightly different set of stakeholders that you engage, and a different approach to gaining comfort on those liabilities.
But sometimes I put myself in the CFO's shoes, right? And I go, well, I haven't engaged an EPR. I've just got an external auditor having engaged an actuary. But through that external audit exercise, I, as a CFO, don't get an overall conclusion on the reasonableness of the overall reserves. All right, increasingly, that's the case. So, I mean, is it time to bring back the EPR?
Well, look, I think just on this one, my view is that IFRS 17 is very complicated. There's capital standards to deal with. A lot of insurers operate across legacy systems, operate internationally and domestically. You have to deal with different laws across the different states. We know how strict ASIC and APRA can be around pricing promises and claims and all of these types of things. And so the world we're living in is quite complicated. And so I think, you know, not necessarily mandating that it comes back. I think it is good practice to have this additional check just because things are complicated. And like looking back, you'd probably want to say we had someone check and they also missed something. It's not necessarily the best answer, but at least you've said you've kicked the tires well enough.
And, you know, we know all of this have come about through how ASIC has enforced the auditing standard, how they've approached the audit inspections program, and also APRA, how they've approached their regulatory exercise. So, Nina, would you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Chair. So I guess the key thing to note here is that there has been a change in the expectations of the regulators in this space. And the change in the expectations has come about off the back of the 2022 Senate inquiry into the auditing approach to auditing. And through that, what we have seen in practice is that ASIC has really lifted its game in terms of the level of scrutiny it actually puts on auditors as to, well, how did you get comfortable that the person doing the review, or the person doing, the primary actuary, in my case, that the bank itself, has done enough. And interestingly enough, sitting in the chair when, being interviewed by ASIC and the PCAOB, so the Professional Accounting Standards Oversight Board, they were asking questions like, well, how did you get comfortable that this was reasonable? And historically, you would use the, looked at a chart and you would use the, well, it's, I use my actuarial judgment, and based on my judgment, the actual versus expected looks reasonable. That's no longer good enough. And so the level of documentation and the expectation of how you get comfortable that what is being done is sufficient has really, really, the bar's been lifted. So that, there's some of the adverse findings that have come out through those kind of audit reviews, And ultimately what happens is that just because you're an actuary, you're treated the same as any other profession in the eyes of the auditing standards. So they don't take into consideration, oh, you're applying an actuarial or professional judgment. It's just you're treated the same way. You followed some procedures, show us where your evidence is. Which is very different to what had been historically. So just, you know, it makes us take pause and go, well, then what are we going to do about it? And then, Chair, maybe if we move on to the next slide, if you can share with us in terms of how this resonates with what's happening both here and overseas.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? So in Australia, we've got professional regulation done by the Actuaries Institute, and we've got ASIC, we've got APRA doing their regulatory work. But if you look at, say, the UK, there's a central regulatory entity, the FRC, and they regulate all professionals in the audit space, so accountants, actuaries. And I think what it's done is it's brought consistency to how different professions approach finance work, if you like, and there's something that we can learn from that, I think, as primary actuaries in Australia, just perhaps adapting ourselves to the way of thinking, finger in the air sort of actuarial judgment type statements. Well, maybe the international auditors do have a point that, you know, you should approach it in a very methodical, prescriptive, procedural-based approach with all the evidence and requirements and so on. So I think we'll bring this to life again. We've covered a lot of these topics of interest of ASIC and what they look for. But, you know, just to bring it to life, I think if you're a general insurance actuary, you would be familiar with something like this, very familiar, right? Say an incurred chain ladder. And traditionally, you know, actuaries in Australia, when we look at this, we go, oh, well, you know, we'll just fit a line through the history. The history is the evidence, and my judgment is the evidence. Oh, let's just go and do that. And by the way, this is fake, but it's based on a real-life example of an audit inspections program with ASIC that I've personally gone through. And ASIC turned around and said, well, if you look at delays 3 and 4 on this graph, well, the primary actuary's chosen assumptions, irrespective of whether it makes a difference, he or she's chosen assumptions that fall outside of what's being presented to you as evidence. So, you know, how has the primary actuary thought about this? How have you, the external auditor, thought about this? You know, is there something you're missing? Are you sure this is volatility? Is there an underlying trend that you haven't really captured? And I just remember sitting in that room at the time. I thought, well, this is so trivial. But upon reflection, in hindsight, I think they do have a point, you know. It takes an outsider to call it out. Maybe the evidence and documentation around some of the assumption selection that we take for granted as actuaries, well, maybe we do need to change the way we think about this and uplift our, you know, the way we do things to bring ourselves to a similar standard to other professions that are engaged in finance work. So, you know, I know, Nina, you've talked about APRA and ASIC. You know, how has the banking industry been approaching all of this?
Yeah, thanks, Chow. So I guess the thing, just to give a bit of a history lesson, just in terms of models within the banking sector and how they're governed and what it means from an APRA perspective. So when Basel II first got introduced within the banking sector, some of the banks were allowed to use their own internal-based models to assess the level of capital that they needed to hold. And one of the quid pro quos with APRA was you're allowed to use your own internal models if you put some additional guardrails in place. You know, guardrails like, you know, we need to make sure you've got the appropriate credit risk management policies in place. But one of those guardrails was actually also any of those models that you're using would need to be independently validated. It didn't say that it needed to be done externally or anything like that, but just somebody else other than the developer needed to have a look at those models. So then what happened off the back of that, each of the banks decided, well, I should put this in a policy, and so the model risk policy was born. And the first question that was being asked by the industry is, what is a model? And it's, you know, may seem somewhat trivial, but there was lots of debates as to is a formula a model and what have you. And so initially, the way the banking sector looked at it was, you know, any credit risk models were models and they needed to be governed by this policy around being, you know, the requirement for validation. And so that has actually evolved over time, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the case study. But that's the idea of the model risk policy initially, was to try and have a look at, well, if you do have this particular capital model that is quite statistical in nature, that you should have it validated just to make sure that it's right when it goes in, and then on an ongoing basis that someone's looking at it to make sure that it continues to be fit for purpose.
Yeah, and thanks, Nina. I mean, what can insurance actuaries learn, right, from banks around all this? What's the best practice that we can pick up?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. So I guess from the banking sector, the thing to note is there isn't a prescription. Like, there isn't anything out there that says, oh, your model risk policy or your model validation needs to capture these things. We actually tend to look overseas for some of these principles, and the model validation approach tends to also be quite principles-based. But the principles on which we follow are outlined on this slide. So what I might do is just talk you through them. So the first one is all around conceptual soundness. So, you know, has the model been designed in such a way that it's fit for the purpose that it's going to be used for? The second one is, well, if you've designed the model appropriately, well, have the assumptions that have been calibrated to that model, are they technically appropriate? Do they mirror historical experience? Have they been set appropriately? The third one that we kind of tend to look at is, we look at, well, what's the outcomes of that model? You know, what is the results? Do the results compare to historical experience? Do we do back tests, what they call kind of back testing, to say, well, based on history, the outcome of this model is okay? Interestingly enough, the other aspects that we do focus quite a bit of attention on is the documentation. So have you actually documented the model in such a way that someone can just come and pick it up and be able to replicate the model without said developer sitting across from you? And we do, that comes to life very much when looking at one of the other boxes on there, which is what we call implementation testing. And so what you end up doing is you take that documentation, and if that documentation is good enough, you'll be able to independently develop that model and then check it against, well, what has the bank actually implemented in system. So it's quite detailed in terms of the level of detail and the granularity that you go into. And then the last two I'll cover off there is the data. So interestingly enough, from a modelling perspective in the banking sector, there are a lot of portfolios in the banking sector that don't actually have much losses. And so as you can appreciate, if you don't have many losses, building a model becomes really hard. And so when we're looking at data, the use of external data is quite prevalent in the banking industry. But to be able to use it, there's lots of rigor and scrutiny over, well, how are you comfortable that that external data is appropriate to your portfolio? What testing have you done to ensure that your portfolio is aligned to that external data so you don't just lift it and use it in practice? And then finally, from a data perspective, there's also quite detailed data testing done around, well, what was the data used for model development, and how do you flow that through, or how do you, you know, test the data lineage of the critical data elements to make sure, well, the data that was being used for modelling purposes and implementation is appropriate. And then finally, governance. So there's a big focus on governance, both from a monitoring perspective, also governance from a, models are never always right. There's always things that go wrong. And so there's a lot of focus around, well, if there's any judgment that's being applied or any overlays that are being applied, what is the appropriate level of governance that's in place? Do the banks have an appropriate level of understanding as to, well, where is all the model risk that exists within your organisation? Do you have 10 models? Do you have 100 models? What's the quality of those models? What's the level of risk associated with them? When was the last time they were reviewed? Have there been any adverse findings from them? So these are all types of questions that we'd be expecting from a governance perspective that the banks are able to answer.
Yeah, that sounds very valuable, Nina. You know, I'm an insurance actuary, and my experience in insurance is CFOs often approach conversations of model validation with a cost lens, you know. So, I mean, is that right or wrong, or can you bring to life for us? Yeah,
the interesting thing is, so where I started this conversation was around kind of credit risk models for capital purposes. But what the banking sector has done, which is actually really quite positive, is taken a step back and said, well, what other models do I use in my organisation, whether it be for capital, whether it be for provisioning, whether it be for remediation, whether it be for kind of marketing and customer related outcomes. So a live example, you know, we've all been to some Gen AI talks. Some banks are now going, oh, well, people are using AI, these running around building AI models and Gen AI models. What am I going to do about that? And how am I going to get comfortable from a model risk perspective that I'm not putting the bank under undue risk? And so what they do is, from a modelling perspective, they've turned around and gone back to their model risk policy. They've enhanced it. They've added what the definition of a model is and been really clear. They've applied a level of materiality. They've also turned around and risk-tiered models to turn around and say, if something's a high-risk model, then it'll impact the level of frequency and depth of the type of validation that you need to do. They've turned around and gone through and updated the approval process to turn around and say, well, we need to incorporate these Gen AI models into this approval process so that when they're thinking about Gen AI, it's thought about within the modelling landscape in totality rather than something centrally. So this is kind of showing how the banks have evolved with the introduction of generative AI, which is happening really like here and now.
Yeah, so Nina, we've heard a lot about how insurers can learn from banks. Is there anything that banks can learn from insurers?
Absolutely. It's a great question. So I think that the thing that's really interesting here is, you know, it's great to see that the Institute has introduced a banking course to be able to, you know, as a profession, we can upskill our people in the banking sector. You know, I had made a prediction maybe 15 years ago to say, well, all, you know, banks' models that are quite statistical in nature should be signed off by an actuary, the same way as insurance liabilities are. I think that would be awesome. And the reason I think it's awesome is due to, if we go to the next slide, Chow, is just to talk a little bit about, well, what is it about the insurance side of things that I think that banks can learn? So when IFRS 9 first got introduced, there was a whole bunch of models that were being built. Large number of data scientists that were hired to apply all these statistical models. You know, build all these Merton models. They were great, very, very statistical, and lots of macroeconomic factors put into them, amazing transformations on a variety of different economic factors. But the thing that was missing, which actuaries are able to bring to the table, is in the insurance sector, actuaries really understand the products that are being developed. They understand the industry, they understand the outcome, they understand the risks that you're actually trying to model. So therefore, when someone is building a model, they don't turn around and just go, oh, I'm just going to fit the thing that's most statistically significant without having a sight to, well, actually, does that make business sense? Is that consistent with the way that you built your last model? How are you applying the change? How are you incorporating experience in future iterations of your model? How do you know that you should update your model? So from an actuarial perspective, the things that we do bring to the table that I think that the banking sector can learn from is the way that we apply our judgment. The actuaries are very have a healthy level of scepticism in them. They don't just accept what's being told to them. We tend to love the ability to standardise the approaches that we're taking when building models. It'd be great to have kind of standards and codes, the way that we apply our professionalism, our code of ethics, so that, you know, if you are coming up with a number, you know, it's not just a number. You apply all the professional judgment and ethics that goes with it. So they're the types of things, Chow, that I think that the banking sector could learn from the insurance sector, because the level of rigour that is applied from an insurance perspective is actually quite special.
I think, you know, the only other things that I would add to that is some other perspectives would be, probably 10 years ago, like at most of these types of events, most of the topics would have been on data science. Like, we would have had 10 data science topics and lots of discussion on, will data scientists replace actuaries? And 10 years later, they really haven't. And I think a lot of that's on those points on the right-hand side of your page around being part of a profession, having consistency in training, going through a rigorous examination process and kind of making sure that the standard is at a certain level, because then it means that the industry is really well looked after as well. Not saying that data science is not useful, but I think that's the additional element that the profession brings to it.
Absolutely.
Lovely. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening to our presentation. I guess we'll pass on to our Chair, Brendan, for Q&A.
Thanks, guys. That was a really good presentation. Given it's a small room, if you've got questions, we can do it in the traditional way and you can stick your hand up. But you can also put them into the app and I'll read them out if you're that way inclined. Are there any questions, comments?
No, if we don't have questions, we're going to make people stand and clap.
Well done. Well done.
Susan.
Thanks. Interesting talk. I talked about a few things that are happening on the audit side that I probably wasn't fully aware of. Now, from the way you were presenting, sort of saying there are things that we can learn from, absolutely. However, one of the challenges we've got is that all our standards are principles-based, and part of that is because we have quite dire consequences for people who don't follow standards. So making it very prescriptive becomes challenging if it's not backed up by legislation. So how would you deal with that particular issue?
So from what I've seen in the UK, and I think that's where they kind of combined the professional standards and the FRC, I think it's called.
Yeah, auditing, yeah.
Under those technical actuarial standards that they've rolled out there. If you look at it, their code of conduct's actually pretty good in terms of the actuary needs to consider the appropriateness of their communication for the audience to which they communicate and be able to justify or at least defend their decisions. And I think that's where that balance with the principle-based standard is versus saying I've just selected something versus saying actually looking at these five data points, applying this, looking at sensitivities and scenarios, my judgment is that it should be this, and hopefully someone else picks it up and says, I can follow that and it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But it is a fine balance because on the other side of the coin, I think US regulations tend to be very prescriptive and very formulaic, which also constrains growth and innovation, and people don't really do much beyond ticking the boxes.
And I think we can learn some of this from the banking industry, right? So classic example, benchmarking or external data. I know in insurance, if you've got a small portfolio, let's say in long-tail insurance, you know, benchmarking against industry data is so important. But I think when it comes to the prescriptive nature of that work, well, perhaps, yes, there is no prescriptive standard or requirement, but should we as primary actuaries be documenting a lot of the consideration that's gone behind? You know, why am I using this APRA industry data? Is it actually relevant for me?
Yeah, and I think it is I don't want us to stand here and make it sound like the primary actuaries aren't doing what they're meant to be doing. That's not the point of the presentation. I think the idea here is that the primary actuary does have a lot of work that they do, and even as reviewing actuaries, we put a lot of thought into what we're doing. It's more around how you articulate it and the level of detail that you go through to be able to articulate it. You can't make assumptions that the person that reading it just will understand what it is that you're talking about. So I think it has to do a lot with both not what you do but how you communicate the decisions that are being made through that process.
So I'm assuming your EPRs would probably be saying that you should improve your documentation quite a bit then.
And sometimes EPRs...
It's not just EPRs, even the model validations, like even the external audits, like documentation, to the point I was saying before around, like if I'm going to take something and independently validate it, I should be able to do that without having to speak to the actuary or the model developer in my case, if the documentation's good enough. Even so far as when people are adding overlays, like documenting why and how and who was in the room when you had the conversation. It's not to say that those processes aren't happening. It's probably that they're not being documented in such a way that someone else can come in and understand it.
Other questions?
Yep. It just seems to me very wasteful to have an actuary doing the job, another one peer reviewing it, and then the auditor's actuaries looking at it again. And you know, there's three actuaries and three opinions that are going to be hard to... Is there a way that we can bring the audit opinion and a peer review opinion together just by the scope of the work those people are doing?
Yeah, I think that is a good point, especially it is expensive. It does take time, and people do get frustrated being asked the same question multiple times. And that's probably one of the reasons that the peer review is no longer a formal requirement in Australia, and in most countries it isn't. I think the other thing to just note is that the audit itself is also not all-encompassing, doesn't test everything, doesn't give comfort on everything at that absolute level. The audit partner will pick what are the significant risks that year, and so something might not be tested in a year. They might just say, well, it wasn't picked this year, it was picked 3 years ago, and they've got finite time and budget, and the CFO is like, I'm only going to pay you this. And so, yes, it is expensive, but also at the same time, like, I don't think any one of those processes in themselves cover everything fully. Like, we've dealt with some appointed actuaries where they don't document anything. They just really just apply judgment. And then that becomes very difficult. It's key man risk for the organization as well. If they were hit by a bus, then what happens? So you do, it's a bit of checks and balances. I mean, I don't know if you've got different perspective, but yes, noted.
And I think sometimes it's also tricky, right? You have an external consultant acting as the AA. You've got an internal chief actuary. You've got some other actuaries doing other models and so on. You know, wouldn't it be nice, as you said, say, with the external audit program, you bring everything under that umbrella. You do an EPR. You do your external audit procedures under the international auditing standards. And you do the model validation exercise all in one go.
Okay. I think that was the final bell, so thanks everybody for joining, and please put your hands together for our speakers. Thank you. Thanks, guys.